Thank you, Your Honor. I'm Mark Sayers, attorney for Aspen Diversified Industries Service, Inc., and my attorney registration number is 19070. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
The yellow light will come on in 5 minutes.
All right, thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. This case of McCoy Little John Child Care Center LLC versus the Aspen Diversified Industry Service Inc., which we'll refer to as Aspen Diversified, involves a case of a claim that Aspen Diversified failed to provide McCoy Little John with a child care center of a defined number of children's capacity within a predefined square footage of a prefabricated unit. The contract at issue in this case did not state in any language whatsoever that is apparent or clear any provision with respect to the number of children that this child care center would be required to accommodate.
Mr. Sayers, I have some questions for you right there. I note that in your briefs you have focused exclusively on the language of the design proposal that was executed in October of 2005 and have not at all addressed the language in the architectural drawings and the standard form agreement and the project drawings that occurred later. Is it your view that those later documents do not matter at all, that the text of those matters don't, those documents don't matter?
Correct, Your Honor. The text of those matters, those design drawings, are not part of the original agreement entered into in October of 2005.
Okay, and what supports your view that that they are essentially irrelevant to the meaning of the contract at issue?
That the parties, neither party has indicated that those terms were ever negotiated between them or had any kind of part and parcel of their establishing their first and original agreement of designing a child care center.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
You say the original agreement. Is it not so that the standard form agreement is an agreement between the parties? Between Aspen and McCoy and Little John?
The standard form agreement, Your Honor, I would actually need to know if you're asking about a specific dated standard form agreement.
The November 14 agreement.
The November 14 agreement, which involved the preliminary design drawings that were presented to the to McCoy Little John.
It incorporated the initial design drawings, and it incorporated the later project design drawings.
So that's what you've been calling the construction contract.
Right, Your Honor, but the construction contract in this case was removed from ADI and made a contract between Cali International and McCoy Little John, not Aspen Diversified. That there was never a construction contract completed, and it was transferred to Cali International.
I guess I didn't see that in your opening brief that mattered. I mean, what I saw you say is the design proposal is everything, and I didn't see really any argument with regard to why you are not bound and why you don't have any breach of contract liability for having initially signed and agreed to the later three documents, the November 12, November 14, and December 30 documents.
The later documents do not dictate a design for 100 child capacity. There was the contemplation in the original agreement that we have focused on that there would be subsequent schematic designs presented to McCoy Little John. Those were in fact done, and the exhibits demonstrated that printed on those design proposals was a specific child capacity of 50 children, and those were presented to McCoy Little John. The original contract has no specific provision, and I think that brings us to talking about the crux of the case. The crux of the case here is whether there is a specific requirement, contractual for 100 children. And that is not found anywhere in any of the documents, including these subsequent construction agreement or in the schematic design proposals. What you have contemplated, even when you, and plaintiff's answer brief even responded by discussing that the experts discussed an ongoing process where something might take place with the design would match, well, the design would be worked out as to what number of children might be accommodated, which does make sense. However, to sue on a claim of breach of contract and to claim that there was an asserted term that was breached for a 100-child capacity, 5,000-square-foot building was not any ambiguity. There was no ambiguity for such a claim by plaintiff in this breach of contract. The trial court.
Counsel, is it a standard in these kinds of agreements to leave out the occupancy as a term of the agreement? I think I read that somewhere. And if so, if I did read that, would you agree with that?
Actually, Your Honor, I wouldn't agree with it specifically, other than the fact that the experts did state that there is a period of working out design. It's like the two sides of a coin, design versus number of children. And that process takes place in the designing proposal, because Aspen Diversified Industries is taking, as the record shows, information from McCoy Littlejohn, specifically in this case, the managing member, Ms. McCoy, about hallways, restrooms, sizes of kitchens, sizes of cubbies for children's clothes. Those things are coming in after this process and after this contract is entered into. What's important in this case is that the term, or the requested term, that came out in the parole evidence, which Aspen Diversified suggests is error to have allowed in trial, was that Ms. McCoy's trying to state that her expectations were such and such that a 100-child capacity child care center would be developed. That was a specifically rejected term, according to even Ms. McCoy's testimony at trial. So what we have are two parties of equal bargaining power. In fact, with respect to the amount of children in a child care center, Ms. McCoy had the superior knowledge and superior position. So arm's length negotiations, and Ms. McCoy affirms that specifically rejected was any claim for 100 child capacity within this 5,000 square foot building. And there's reason to that, given that ADI, or Aspen Diversified, is being asked to take a predefined square footage and then promise ahead of time that it can fit 100 children into that, not having any idea at that point in time what Ms. McCoy is going to say about restrooms, hallways, and numbers of buildings or numbers of rooms. So it's specifically excluded, not just haphazardly or intent or as practice excluded. So there was a specific exclusion of that term. And McCoy Littlejohn cannot create a ambiguity and declare a breach of contract for failure to get 100 children by simply saying the terms aren't in there. That does not create an ambiguity in Colorado law, as we've set forth in the briefs. With respect to the breach of fiduciary duty claims, and so much of what has transpired at trial required parole evidence to come into play, and of course the court had allowed a breach of fiduciary duty claim. However, this claim really should have been disallowed by the motion for summary judgment and overturned by the judgment notwithstanding the verdict, because there is no traditional fiduciary duty between the parties here. We have two contracting parties, as I've stated already, at arm's length negotiating, one specifically rejecting a provision for 100 child capacity, which defines even what was the scope of any alleged fiduciary duty at trial. Instead, the court allowed not just fiduciary duty claim to go forward, but allowed a jury instruction with a broad, undefined scope for what that fiduciary duty might be. It was the court's obligation to define a scope specifically. However, Aspen Diversified would maintain that it was an error of law for the court to have allowed the fiduciary duty claim to go forward. There was no traditional fiduciary duty, and there was no confidential relationship. Even the testimony of Mrs. McCoy made that clear, that she had never met these men before. The only connection was a father of one of the children she had had in a prior childcare center knew somebody that worked at one at Aspen Diversified. And on that basis, she went and negotiated. She met for 1 hour in a meeting one day. She took home a contract after being told specifically they would not include 100 child capacity. They came back and attempted to negotiate for that and did not get that. There's no.
Yeah, I'm going to interrupt you for a minute. It seems to me that what you're doing is you're arguing the facts, and obviously we don't find facts. So the issue that we have here is, was there any evidence upon which the jury could have concluded, reached the conclusion they did? And is your argument that there is no evidence upon which the jury could have concluded? And if so, would you address that?
Yes, Your Honor. If I address that point of insufficient probable force or probative force for any finding that there was a fiduciary duty, the need here would be for them to find a confidential relationship exists. The testimony from even the plaintiffs, McCoy Littlejohn, failed to allow for any such conclusion.
Mr. Sayers, am I correct in understanding that this record that we have does not include a transcript of Mr. Garza's testimony?
Yes,
I understand. Would you explain to me why that doesn't necessarily defeat all of your claims premised on insufficient evidence?
Your Honor, because I think that it's, first of all, going to be premised and easily understood that Mr. Garza's testimony supported his actions in defending himself against these claims. The requirement here is that the Aspen Diversified shows that there's insufficient probative evidence or any legitimate inferences from, and the place to address that is with the testimony that was presented against us.
Aren't we required to presume that Mr. Garza's testimony supports the verdict? Aren't there cases that say when we have a missing transcript, we presume that it supports the verdict?
Your Honor, I would have to address that for the court at another time. I cannot address that directly today. I can also, if the court would allow a supplement of that, it apparently was the video deposition and somehow did not get put into transcript form for the court reporter, which is why it was missing. And I can supplement the record with that.
Can I deny that?
We can take them. Unless you're ruling on that.
Go ahead.
Your Honor, and I would like to go ahead and reserve my time. I have about 2 minutes and 20 seconds left.
Thank you, Mr. Sars. To the extent that you have moved to supplement the record, we will consider that motion.
Good morning. My name is Greg O'Boyle, attorney registration number 29008. I represent McCoy and Littlejohn Childcare Center LLC, and Kimberly McCoy, the principal of McCoy and Littlejohn, is here with me today. McCoy and Littlejohn approached Aspen Diversified Services Industries, Inc., or ADI, as I will call them, about designing and constructing a child care center. This was to be a design-build project. And the reason that they approached ADI about building this child care center was they were operating their business out of their home and they needed a bigger facility to accommodate more children.
So, boy, I'm going to interrupt you, and let's get as quickly as possible to the issues. Mr. Sars says that the only agreement between the parties here that is at issue is the design proposal, and that you are your amended complaint withdrew any concern about a breach of contract related to anything other than the design proposal. Is that so?
I believe that's the theory of the case that we went forward on, Your Honors, that the design proposal was the agreement between the parties. And however, the other agreements were admitted into evidence, and the jury was there was a breach of contract claim in front of the jury, and the jury was free to find that there was a breach of contract under any of the agreements that were reached by the parties.
Okay,
so that's not the main argument that we made.
Was it withdrawn from your complaint? I mean, did you, when you amended your complaint, did you change it so that there was no breach of contract claim with regard to documents other than the design proposal?
I don't think we specifically withdrew that. I think we withdrew any construction claims against ADI or Aspen Diversified, but any design claims remained.
Okay. So you withdrew any claim that they had breached the construction contract?
Right, or the construction aspects of any other agreements that there may have been between the parties.
So, as I'm understanding, you're saying that they did not breach construction requirements, but are you also saying that they did not breach the standard form agreement that the judge ended up interpreting with regard to the words occupant load 50?
Well, what I'm saying is that I'm not saying I withdrew that argument. I'm just saying that that wasn't the primary argument that I made, that we made at trial.
You didn't try the case on that basis. The judge did end up entering those other documents into evidence, and Mr. Garza was also one of the defendants.
Yes, he was one of the defendants, yes.
All right, so now what we have here is this design proposal, and among your complaints is that that was breached? The design proposal was breached?
Yes, the design proposal was breached, and the way it was breached is there's a duty of good faith and fair dealing that's implied in every contract in Colorado, and that duty of good faith and fair dealing requires that the reasonable expectations of the parties are met. And that is the factual issue that was presented to the jury at trial primarily.
Are you saying in essence that the duty of good faith and fair dealing really, it almost incorporates a negligence standard, that the person with whom you are contracting, the person who's designing this building, essentially has the duty not to be negligent in the design, has a duty to incorporate your client's reasonable demands and reasonable requirements and design a building that will meet those needs?
Well, I wouldn't term it a negligence standard. I would say that it's a standard that's consistent with the party's expectations, which is, as the experts testified, what happens in a design contract is the parties enter into a design contract. Normally, capacity is not a term that's specifically indicated in the agreement, and that's something that the parties come to and eventually. And the requirement was that McCoy and Littlejohn's needs be met. And there was expert testimony that a 5,000 square foot building could meet the needs of McCoy and Littlejohn. Our expert testified that just raising the building up and turning the crawl space into usable space would have given them plenty of space to allow them to serve the children they needed to generate the revenue necessary.
I appreciate your argument, and I will tell you that it's surprising to me that the implied duty of good faith and fair dealing is that broad. Do you have some authority that would be instructive on this point about, support the conclusion that this sort of contract term, that we're going to build a building, design a building to incorporate, to accommodate 100 children, that sort of term can be in part of the implied duty of good faith and fair dealing?
Well, I don't think that that you're implying a specific term into the contract. I think what you're implying is that there is a duty here. There is a duty to meet the reasonable expectations and to meet the reasonable expectations of McCoy and Littlejohn. And I think that there are a few cases that a few Colorado cases that are instructive here. One of them is the Hayman Contractors case. And in the Hayman Contractors case, Hayman contracted with its subcontractor. And I can give you the site for that case.
We've cited it and we can find it. That's
okay. The Hayman contracted with its subcontractor, and the terms of the agreement actually specifically state that Hayman can dictate to the subcontractor when and how it's going to do its paving. And Hayman argued that the duty of good faith and fair dealing couldn't inject a term for it to be reasonable with respect to when and how its work would be performed under that contract. But the Court of Appeals said, yes, you can. The duty of good faith and fair dealing does inject that. And if you didn't inject that, Hayman could require the subcontractor to do its work at midnight using
pieces. Of course. But that case, as I understand it, then would support the very point that your colleague here has conceded, which is that the implied duty of good faith and fair dealing concerns the manner in which agreed upon terms are carried out and doesn't add new terms or additional terms to the contract. And this is my concern here. If I look at that design proposal, I don't see anything about occupancy load.
But they are required to design a child care center. And implied in that is it has to hold some children. If you take the appellant's argument, they could design a child care center as long as it gets a certificate of occupancy. If it holds no children at all, then they've satisfied their obligations under their design agreement.
But here it did hold children, right? 59 was what it was approved for.
It did hold 59 children, but that wasn't, if it holds zero or 59, my client's business is still doomed to failure, and they haven't done what ADI has not done what they were required to do under that agreement. ADI met with the Department of Child Services, or the Department of Humans, Colorado Department of Human Services, which sets the capacity for the rooms.
I'm going to interrupt you, Mr. O'Boyle. Certainly we understand your argument that under the duty of good faith and fair dealing, they had the obligation to meet the expectations of your client, and there is evidence in the record that there was a basis for them to have known the expectations of your client. So we really don't need to go into all of that particular evidence. We're aware of it.
Okay.
Let me ask you this. Do you agree? I think your counterpart said during his argument that they had specifically rejected the idea of occupancy of 100. Do you agree with that?
I think that piece of testimony is taken out of context. It's in the context of what they agreed to was to build a child care center that would meet the needs of McCoy and Little John. I do not think that the specific term was rejected. There's nothing in there that says there's no guarantees with respect to capacity in this child care center. If that was the case, then maybe we would have a different case here. But we have a case where the experts say this is a specific term that's not normally contained in a design contract.
Right, it's not normally contained. That's why I'm wondering if there's anything in the record where they specifically say we're not doing 100 children, or we're not agreeing to that, or we're not going to put that in writing.
Well, I believe that there was some testimony to that effect, but that's one piece of testimony that the jury weighed here, and they rejected that, and they found that ADI did breach its contract, and that the reasonable expectations of McCoy and Little John were not met here, and so I think that the overwhelming evidence here is on the side of McCoy and Little John and the jury verdict.
Mr. O'Boyle, I'm going to ask you to move on now to the fiduciary duty issue.
Okay. With respect to the fiduciary duty issue, I think that there are a number. First of all, I think the most important thing with respect to fiduciary duty is that the jury was instructed with the instructions that were provided by and tendered by the defendant, ADI, in this case. And based on those instructions and the law that is set forth in those instructions, the evidence, the overwhelming evidence at trial, supports a verdict in favor of my clients on the fiduciary duty claim. The second of all, with respect to if you feel that there needs to be a confidential relationship, there is evidence of a confidential relationship between Ms. McCoy and Mr. Burrs. And Mr. Burrs was not just somebody who was at, not just somebody who had taken his child to the child care center previously. He went to church. He was somebody who Ms. McCoy and Ms. Littlejohn trusted, and they testified that he was somebody that they trusted. And he took them to ADI and Mr. Garza, and they said, "Trust us. We'll give you a turnkey project. Trust us. You take care of the children. We'll take care of giving you the child care center you need."
So are you saying that there was an existing confidential relationship prior to entering into the agreement, or that a confidential relationship was established upon entering into the agreement?
I'm actually saying both. I'm saying that there was a confidential relationship between McCoy and Littlejohn and Mr. Robert Burrs, who was an ADI agent at the time, and he's the one who brought McCoy and Littlejohn to ADI. Said you can trust me. Second of all, everything that ADI did here to showed that they were taking responsibility for this, and they were taking control of the design aspects of this project. And by doing that, and by saying, "Trust us, you take care of the children," and by being the only person who communicates, who submits the application to the Colorado Department of Human Services, I think that a confidential relationship was established in that way as well.
So are you saying there was an agreement that ADI would be the party to submit the request to DHS and obtain the authorization for the occupancy, certificate of occupancy?
I'm saying that they undertook that responsibility, assumed that responsibility, and actually that is what happened, and that's what the testimony showed at trial.
So, I mean, was it just simply to submit it or to get it approved?
Well, they were required to submit it, to figure out what they needed to do, and to get it approved for the 100 occupancy.
So the fiduciary duty then would encompass, in your view, the duty to submit it, to design it, build it, submit it, and get it approved for 100 children, and that was the fiduciary duty?
Yes. Well, and with respect to getting it approved, I think it's getting it designed, figuring out what it takes to design the child care center, and designing it in that manner. That is their responsibility, and that's what my clients relied on, and they took complete control of that design. One thing that we have not addressed is damages. Do you have any other questions, or should I move on to damages?
You're about out of time, so you give us, start a sentence about damages.
If I could ask a question, I would.
Oh, okay. He has a question.
Not about damages, but about your last argument. And it's an intriguing one to me. As I understand it, your argument is that on the question of the breach of fiduciary duty, whether there is a fiduciary duty to this kind of relationship is a question of fact. So far, so good? That is your position, right?
Yes, absolutely.
And that although your colleague moved for summary judgment on this point, they also submitted jury verdicts which did not require the jury to determine that fact. And that now, on appeal or in a JNOV, basically your opponent here is left challenging the evidence whether it's sufficient to support the jury's determinations of fact. And if the instructions didn't require the jury to determine that fact, that's something that is essentially abandoned now or forfeited, that the argument has been forfeited.
Yes.
Okay. I'm sorry that I articulated that badly, but that is my understanding of your argument.
Okay.
Have you any case or authority that would have applied that sort of principle in an analogous situation? It's an interesting argument to me, but I haven't seen it before.
I don't think I have a case specifically on point, but But there are a few cases that are cited in my brief. One is for the proposition that once you file a motion for summary judgment and it's denied and you go to trial, that's over. So what the argument is, once it's over and you submit jury instructions, that contradict to a certain extent your motion for summary judgment, then you can't go back and say, well, my summary judgment motion, rely on your summary judgment motion for that. You have to rely on your jury instructions. And there is also lots of case law on the position that once you submit jury instructions, you've invited error. You can't benefit from your error that you've invited into the case if it is, you know, if arguably it would be error. And therefore, you're stuck with the jury instructions that you present. You need to object to those jury instructions or you're stuck with them.
Okay. So, although the short answer was no, I appreciate your answer.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, I have a housekeeping question. In his argument, your counterpart asked about a motion to supplement the record, and I wanted your position on that before you sit down.
I would object to the supplementation of the record. I think that, you know, my client does believe that the evidence in Mr. Garza's testimony does support her case. But the time for submitting the record has passed, and I think it's too late to supplement the record at this time, so we would object to that.
Mr. Sarge, rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, the argument by McCoy Littlejohn with respect to good faith and fair dealing sort of misconstrues the case law on that subject, and it does require that a specific provision in the contract that was eventually signed be permitting a sole discretion to one party, which when they abuse it and don't act in good faith, can defeat everything about the intentions of the parties. In this case, there was no provision permitting sole discretion to anyone. There was no provision at all, and then there was no ongoing intention for a designing phase that would have allowed sole discretion to Aspen Diversified. So the doom to failure, the argument about the action does not turn Aspen Diversified into a guarantor for McCoy Littlejohn that it will have a viable business that's running forward. In that regard, it was good faith. If there was every question about it was good faith for them to continue to advise them during the design phase that here 50 child occupancy is the number here on this document. This is for you to review. With respect to the argument for a fiduciary, ADI did not submit to the department for the child care. I'm sorry, I can't think of the correct title at that point, but it was submitted by McCoy Littlejohn, not by Aspen Diversified. And also it occurred in the time frame when Aspen Diversified had been taken out of the mix, as testified by Ms. Hippolito, and I do disagree with plaintiff's counsel's interpretation of her testimony in his brief, who says that, listen, Mr. Garza and Mr. Borrella were out of here in February, like 15th and 18th or 28th, and they were no longer being paid and they were no longer the people in charge of this contract. And Mr. Burr's relationship to the McCoy Littlejohn does not turn a broad scope of fiduciary duty when there was, you know, when this is not the traditional notion of a fiduciary. ADI is not acting as a trustee or trustor, is not acting as an attorney client. They're not in business just to be on the benefit for some other party. They're contracting and of course would want someone to trust them enough to bring a contract to them. I see my time is out.
Thank you, Mr. Sayers. Maybe a question?
One question. Your colleague here has argued that, as I understand the argument, that when the amended complaint was filed, the plaintiffs relinquished any claim based on the construction contract, but that the documents executed after the design proposal did bear on the meaning of the design contract or the design agreement. I would like your position on that argument.
There was in April 24th, I believe it was, of 2006, a then new design and construction contract executed with Cali International. It is apparent from the transcript that the two principals that had begun had moved over to that new company. But there was a new design contract, and this construction did not even begin until the fall of April 2006. So we're talking from February to November, December, when Cali was in charge of that. And the whole construction phase was essentially turned completely over to Cali. And as I understand, even McClure Littlejohn doesn't dispute that that was the case. And that's the reason for their amended complaint and their statement of what they were proceeding on.
So is it your position that those documents are irrelevant?
And once again, are we referring to the design proposal submitted in November and December of 2005?
Yes, it was. So there was an architectural design, roughly November 12. There was a standard form contract, roughly November 14, and a project design in December.
I think those reflect a phase, an initial phase, and perhaps a second phase of here's design interactions between McCoy Littlejohn and ADI at that time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. We'll take the motion to supplement the record under advisement and notify both counsel promptly after we've had a chance to discuss it. The case is now submitted. An opinion will issue in due course. Thank you for your